Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for taking the time to be with us on my show tonight. We have a great segment for the next 5 weeks, and I'm going to put them on both. Some of them are going to be on this show, and some of them are going to be on my show on Revealing Talk Radio on the Eva Herr Show. That after they're all done, I want you to know that we will rerun them again, all five of them, on both networks, so that no one has to miss anything, because I've had so many emails, people writing and wanting to know where they could hear these because they couldn't be here tonight. So just know that we will redo this again. So back in September of last year, I had a sudden and massive heart attack. And so I'm better now. In fact, I'm doing great. And I decided to do a segment on all of the things that I learned to do, walk a holistic alternative path for heart disease. And tonight I have with us one of the main people who helped me walk this path, Dr. Stephen Sinatra. This week we're going to talk about the great cholesterol myth and how cholesterol is not really the thing that's causing heart disease, not like it they say anyway. We're also going to have a segment on genetics and the MTHFR mutation. And we're going to have another segment with Dr. Sinatra, and we're going to talk about early detection, prevention, and treatment with holistic mechanisms. Then we're going to have another segment on blood viscosity using natokinase and vitamin K2 with Dr. Ralph Falsworth. And another segment with John St. Cyr talking about the use of D-ribose. And we'll have Dr. Benjamin Lynch talking to us about the genetic modifications and MTHFR. So, welcome, Dr. Sinatra. I'm so glad to have you, and I know that my listeners are literally chomping at the bit to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be here, Eva, and I'm sorry I'm going to miss some of the shows. Those sounds like great shows for heart disease and, you know, and for, you know, the whole subject of prevention and solutions and everything else. So good luck with all those other shows.
Well, it's really exciting, and I think we'll help a whole lot of people. And I know you have a lot of things to say, and I have 5 pages of questions whenever you don't have anything to say. So why don't, before we get started, tell us about your seminar that you're doing in September and where we can find you. The seminar is kind of like an added bonus beyond this 5 series segment.
Yeah, on September 19th, I'm going to have a webinar. It's on the great cholesterol myth. And it's basically, I'm going to be answering questions about, you know, cholesterol and heart disease. I'm going to be talking about my pillars of healing, you know, how to help prevent heart disease. There'll be questions on that. And basically, I'm really going to talk about this whole cholesterol myth about, you know, why it started and why it's stolen the whole stage in heart disease today. And it's probably the biggest myth, and I hate to say this, but it's almost like a scam of the 21st century. I mean, I literally answer questions almost every day about cholesterol and heart disease. And the real travesty is that, you know, when it comes to statin drugs are very, very good for middle-aged men. I mean, if a middle-aged man has heart disease or a heart attack or a stent or a bypass, I would use a statin because not of its cholesterol-lowering capabilities, but because they do good things in men. You know, they thin the blood, they can affect the HDL, they're antioxidants, they're anti-inflammatories. But in women, I have been very, very disappointed in what statins do. And unfortunately, almost every day I hear of a woman who I consult on, or even last night I went out to dinner with a doctor and his wife, and I hear about women being treated just because they have a high cholesterol. They don't even have heart disease. They just have a high cholesterol, and they're being treated with statin drugs to lower their cholesterol. And just last week, Eva, I was on a phone with a woman from Iowa who literally was in tears. She was about 50 years old. She had a bypass. And by the way, her total cholesterol is 150. and her HDL was 60. Her HDL and her LDL were equal. They were both 68. And the doctors put her on statin drugs, and she had horrific side effects. And she kept telling the doctors what was going on, and they sort of, you know, they didn't care. They said, you got to take this drug. And she really got hurt in the process, not from her heart disease, but from, because her heart disease was doing fine. I mean, she was bypassed. She was asymptomatic. She wasn't having any angina. She had a great quality of life. But what was happening was she was suffering from side effects of statins. So my webinar is going to be about everything I said, about statins, who they're good for, who they're not good for, who should take statins, who shouldn't, why they're bad in women, why I don't like them in the elderly, why I don't like them in, you know, 99% of children. And basically I'll talk about, you know, saturated fats and cholesterol and why this myth got propagated. And I'll talk about other solutions for heart disease, you know, my six pillars of healing, like, you know, using lifestyle modifications like an all-organic diet and using forms of exercise to, you know, to help stimulate, you know, hormones in the body and aid detoxification. I'll talk about detoxification. I'll talk about earthing because I believe earthing is very instrumental in not only preventing heart disease but also supporting the process and controlling it. And I'll talk about some mind-body interactions and basically what supplements people need for a healthy heart, you know, what supplements support the heart. So that's what about, I think it's about, it was scheduled for about an hour and I think 20 minutes or 30 minutes, 40 minutes maybe. So I'm sure I'll be able to answer a lot of questions and also give a lot of information as well.
So will you literally take questions?
I believe so. You know, I've already answered a few questions because, in other words, when people come online, you want to be able to have some questions already answered. But I'm sure I'm going to be answering questions at the same time the seminar, well, maybe when the seminar is ongoing or over.
Okay. And where will this be? How will people find it?
I'm going to, where will it be? If they want to go to heartmdinstitute.com, I think they can opt in and get into the seminar that way. They could go to drsinatra.com, but I don't know the link. But if they went to heartmdinstitute.com and inquire about the cholesterol seminar, it's probably already up there on the website. I should have known this information. I didn't know you could ask me the question. But basically, if you go to heartmdinstitute.com, I'm sure it's being advertised, and you could just click on and get a reservation or, you know, just plan on attending.
Okay. And for anybody who can't find it or doesn't know how to find it, email me at evaher@gmail.com, and I will make sure that you get put in touch with the right person to find out how to sign up for that. Okay. Are you ready for questions?
I'm ready for questions, sure.
Okay. So we agreed before, your marketing manager told me you wanted to talk mostly about cholesterol tonight, so that's kind of where most of my questions are directed. And the next interview we'll do, early detection, prevention, and treatment. But you can, I'll give you time before this show's over to talk about anything you want to talk about, okay? So first of all, just to get started, what is cholesterol? Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? Is it things we get from food? Is it a hormone? What is it?
Well, you know, it's sort of a waxy substance. It's vital for the body, I'll tell you that. I mean, you know, it lubricates our skin. It's made by the liver. It's also found in foods, you know, like, you know, fatty meats and eggs and oils. It's found in saturated fat, and the body makes it. So you can eat it, and the body makes it. But it's vital for life. I'll tell you that. It's absolutely vital for life. Look, cholesterol makes all our sex hormones, whether it's the adrenal cortical hormones or whether, you know, it's testosterone or progesterone for a man or a woman. It makes our bile salts, so it's instrumental in digestion. It helps to digest fats. It is very essential for what we call neurotransmitter delivery of impulses in the brain. In other words, cholesterol is found in the brain. The brain is mostly fat. It's composed of DHA, docosahexaenoic acid. And in the brain, We need cholesterol to help form what we call myelin sheaths of major nerves. And in the brain, it's required for the neurotransmission of impulses, so the impulses can talk to one another. So, cholesterol has a lot of, vital functions. And one of the most important is that when sunlight hits your skin, if you're out in the sun, and if you're in the sun for 15 minutes, it's not going to hurt you. But if you're out in the sun, the sunlight hits the skin, and the cholesterol in the skin combined with sunlight helps to form vitamin D3. And you know how vital vitamin D3 in the body is. So, cholesterol has all these functions. And another function it has, it's the repair substance. In other words, we know that inflammation is the root cause of heart disease. Now, if you do have inflammation going on in your blood vessels, when our cholesterol is literally called there to help put out the fire of inflammation or help, support what we call the endothelial lining of the membrane. So it's almost like, vilifying or shooting the firemen that go to a fire. Cholesterol is there to help repair, the basement membrane. It's helped to repair the cell. But in the process of repair, it can lay down plaque, especially if the cholesterol becomes oxidized by heavy metals or by EMF or radio frequencies or radiation or trans fats, So if the environment of the cholesterol becomes toxic, so to speak, then the cholesterol can become angry. It can become oxidized. And when it becomes oxidized, then it can be an inflammatory component, even though, it's called on in situations to repair. So, most of the cholesterol in our body is harmless. However, if it does become oxidized, then it can be found at the scene of a heart attack. And I've always told people that, look, cholesterol is not the cause of heart disease. It may contribute to heart disease, but we give it far too much airtime in America. It's found at the scene of the crime, but it's not the perpetrator. There are far many other perpetrators that can cause, what we call endothelial cell dysfunction or endothelial cell inflammation, and sugar is at the top of the list. Sugar and trans fats are 1 and 2. And then if I went down the list, I would, call in heavy metals, insecticides, pesticides, chemicals, certainly cigarette smoke, radiation, even pharmaceutical drugs can be very toxic to the body, that they can cause inflammation. So anything that can cause inflammation of the delicate membranes of blood vessels is really the indicators or the players that can cause inflammation of the blood vessels, which can eventually cause plaque and narrowing of the blood vessel. But again, oxidized cholesterol or Lp(a), which is a small particle of cholesterol, which is actually carried genetically. This is why I'm in favor of genetic testing, is because if you do have high levels of Lp(a), that's the real cholesterol story. That's a very, very inflammatory particle of cholesterol that if you don't neutralize it, you can get excessive inflammation in the blood vessels, and when that happens, it can set the stage for excessive repair, and when that happens, you can lay down plaque and then, get clogging of the vessels. So it's a very, very, the whole subject of cholesterol is a very poorly understood process, but the tragedy is that we want to kill it, we want to lower it, we want to get rid of it, and the truth is, it's needed by the body. It's only under certain circumstances is when it becomes oxidized or angry do we want to modify it, or do we want to modify it if we have this Lp(a) character, which again is very what we call prothrombotic, means it enhances blood clotting and is very, very inflammatory at the same time. So I sort of gave you an overview of cholesterol about what it is, and I hope it didn't confuse too many people. But again, it's not as cut and dry as a television says. you have a good cholesterol and a bad cholesterol, and you want to knock it down. There is nothing farther from the truth about what you're seeing on television.
Okay. I have 4 or 5 more pages of notes that I want to ask you from. But I want, if you can, I'd like for you to tell me in a short response why people should believe you, because everybody knows about the studies that the National Academy of Science and Nutrition did and the USDA. So if you could just give us briefly why people should believe you and not those studies.
Sure, sure. You know, first of all, let me handle the thing about studies. I mean, you know, studies are good. I mean, but I have to tell you, after being in this business for over 4 decades, I've seen a lot of fuzzy mathematics when it comes to studies. I mean, I've seen statistics that if you go into a study with a conclusion beforehand, you can manipulate those statistics any way you want. So, you know, studies are good, but you got to keep studies in perspective. You really do. And you know, the gold standard of medicine are double-blind trials, which again, are good. However, when we start talking about relative risk and absolute risk, then we're really playing games with statistics. And, you know, if the studies show that we could prevent 1 heart attack in 100 people over a course of 5 years, well, that's sort of okay. But, you know, you'd have to treat millions of people to make a dent in the population. And when you're treating all those people, you've got to consider the enormous amount of side effects you're going to get. And the truth is, you know, a lot of these studies do show that when you use these drugs, you will get less heart attack or less what we call cardiovascular events, less re-bypass, you know, less re-stenting and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, the drugs do not show an increase in longevity because when you factor out things like anything from suicide to severe depression to homicide to cancer to other illnesses, the people taking the statin drugs as opposed to the controls taking no drugs with heart disease, the outcomes aren't different. So I just wanted to handle the studies first. Now, why should people believe what I have to say? Well, I can just say this. I mean, I used to be the choir boy for cholesterol when I was chief of cardiology at my institution. I believed in the theory. I used to lecture for drug companies in the 80s very late 70s and the early 80s. And I really did believe that cholesterol caused heart disease. In fact, I did thousands of cardiac catheterizations. That's when you put a little catheter in the groin or the arm and you would inject what we call contrast material into the heart. And I always thought that with people at high cholesterol, they would have heart disease. But they didn't. I mean, I found people with cholesterols of 140, 150, 160 who were riddled with heart disease. And I had people that had cholesterols of 270 up to 300 who did not have heart disease. And it didn't make sense. And I used to question the data. And back in 1993, when I realized that coenzyme Q10 was being negatively impacted by statin drugs, then I asked myself the question, and this is like 20 years ago, I asked myself the question, how could a drug be so good for the heart and take out cholesterol, but at the same time take out the most vital nutrient that the heart requires survival for? It didn't make sense. So since 1993, I stopped lecturing for drug companies, and basically I started to look at this cholesterol hypothesis as only a hypothesis. I started to question it, and then I reviewed a lot of cases that I had with full-blown heart disease, and what I came up was with things like, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, high homocysteine, high fibrinogen, high C-reactive proteins. These are all inflammatory mediators, and I basically realized that when it came down to risk factors, cholesterol was really low down on the totem pole, but yet we gave it all this airtime. So, you know, why should people believe me? I would say, you know, I got 40 plus years in cardiology, and you know, I've treated thousands and thousands of patients. I was a very, very busy cardiologist. I was a midnight hero for years, you know, working day and night. And, you know, after writing, you know, a dozen or so books and writing a newsletter for almost 20 years and, you know, not only treating patients in my own office, but, you know, treating thousands and thousands, you know, via newsletter and other vehicles and writings, I got to really understand, you know, what really causes heart disease. And a lot of people don't realize it, Eva, but, you know, if I had to take the top two causes of heart disease, you know, inflammation of the vessels or plaque rupture, I would say, you know, emotional stress, number one, and sugar, number two. So, you know, if you have those two risk factors where, you know, you feel trapped or you have heartbreak or you know, you got an enormous amount of held in anger or sadness, and, you know, you're driving your car with your brakes on, so to speak, you know, you're emotionally blocked, and, you know, you have a sugar situation at the same time, or you thrive on sugar, I think those are the two most disastrous ingredients for heart disease, followed by LP little a, which is a small cholesterol, you know, particle. I feel that those risk factors are way more significant than having a cholesterol of 300 or 285 or 325. I mean, to me, those risk factors are much more significant than a high cholesterol.
So, what about, I don't want to get off on this topic, I just want to ask you, what about bergamot? Is there a role for that in your diet?
Well, citrus bergamot is kind of interesting. It comes from Calabria, Sicily, or Italy, in that region, southern Italy. And it is a citrus tree that's about 4 or 5 feet high. And it's a flavonoid. In other words, inside the fruit, it's a bioflavonoid, almost similar to like vitamin C derivatives. But it is kind of interesting. It is this natural, you can almost call it an herb, you know, or a polyphenol, a bioflavonoid. It's very interesting. It's almost like a gift to people with high lipids and high blood sugar at the same time. In other words, what bergamot does, it reduces blood sugar. It reduces triglycerides, which is another fatty substance in the blood, which I feel is, again, more important than cholesterol. And it increases HDL. Now, HDL, and this is where the television does sort of a good thing. It calls it the good cholesterol. It shouldn't vilify LDL as a bad cholesterol, because remember, there's different types of LDL. And not all LDL is harmful. It's only harmful when it's oxidized. But basically, if you have a high triglyceride situation and a low HDL, this is a bad situation where you can have a high ratio. Let me give you an example. If you have triglycerides of 300 and an HDL of 30, what's the ratio? Figure that. You got 300 over 30, so your ratio is going to be 10, right? 30 into 300 is 10.
Oh, yes, sure.
You got it?
Yes, gotcha.
Okay, so basically, that's a horrible ratio. The ratio you want is less than 2. So if your triglycerides are 100 and your HDL is 50, that's a nice ratio. That's 2. The ideal ratio is less than 2, but, you know, when I treated people with nutraceuticals, and even bergamot comes into the picture, because what bergamot does, it lowers triglycerides, it raises HDL, it also lowers blood sugar, and in the process also lowers total cholesterol as well. So it's almost like the trifecta or super perfecta. It does a lot of good stuff. And I like it because it's a nice anti-inflammatory component as well. So bergamot is one of the things I use. Now, it also has a weak statin effect. In other words, it works on pathways similar to statins, but it does not compromise coenzyme Q10 the way statins do. But if people took very, very large doses of bergamot, like let's say 2,000 milligrams a day, it would probably act more like a drug. And in those circumstances, it may impact coenzyme Q10 levels. But I only give people 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day at the most.
So do you take it a couple of times a day, or do you take it with meals?
You can take it a couple times a day. We can take it at bedtime or, after meals. I mean, one of the things that I found with people is that, compliance is important. But at least if people get in, a supplement at least once a day, every day, that's okay with me. And twice a day can be better because of absorption. It's always better to go twice a day. But after taking care of patients for a long time, compliance is an issue. So I always strive to get in something at least once a day.
Okay.
Sometimes when you ask people to do things three or four times a day, even the best intentions in patients always doesn't work that way. I mean, lots of times there's forgetfulness and, but anyway, if I can get people to take something once a day, I'm satisfied with that.
Unless it's me where I walk on with my thoughts with me, that's
24 hours a day. Say that again, Eva.
Unless it's somebody like me who takes too many.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have a lot of discipline because you take a lot of supplements and, you have discipline. And I used to love to have people in my practice like you because they were the easiest to treat. The problem is that a lot of people don't have the discipline. And you don't want to make them wrong. You just want to, say, look, do you brush your teeth once a day? Yes. Do you brush your teeth twice a day? Yes. Well, twice is better than once. But I want you to take this at least once a day and preferably twice a day.
Okay. My next question is, and this is kind of off topic, but I bet I got 12 or 13 emails asking for you to address this question. Some while we've been sitting here on the phone. I've gotten questions about atrial fibrillation, a lot of questions. What can I do?
Oh, atrial fibrillation?
Yes.
Okay.
So could you say something about that, please?
Yeah, atrial fibrillation is almost becoming an epidemic in the society today. It's getting more and more common. And the reason, and I have an idea about that, and one of the reasons why it's becoming more and more common is that our computerized society with high technology and Wi-Fi and cordless phone, cellular phone, radio frequency waves, I mean, we live in a soup of radio frequency, and some of the worst radio frequency waves are smart meters, and what we're seeing is that these radio frequency waves, they can what we call disrupt heart rate variability, or basically they can be disruptive to the point where the heart can get out of rhythm, and when the heart can get out of rhythm, that can set the stage for what we call ectopic impulses, which can fire the heart erratically and cause atrial fibrillation. So there's a lot of factors associated with atrial fibrillation. You could have an overactive thyroid and not know it. You could be taking certain drugs like asthma type of medications or breathing medications that could trigger atrial fibrillation. You could have a cordless phone in the house that could trigger it. So it's almost like the perfect storm, so to speak. If you have a lot of what we call factors like alcohol on board or a lot of sugar on board in the body or having a lot of anger and be exposed to Wi-Fi or radio, a lot of radio frequency waves at the same time, all these things can cause triggers. And when you have a lot of triggers, it can set the heart out of rhythm. And when that happens, the patient can experience, a rapid irregular heartbeat that is atrial fibrillation. And again, we're seeing a lot more cases. And a lot of them are being precipitated by Wi-Fi and radio frequency. But unfortunately, 99% of the cardiologists in the country aren't privy to that yet. They'll learn that over the next 3 or 4 years. But right now, it's sort of it's almost disbelieved that, these waves that you can't see, feel, touch, smell, or taste can be causing harm. But they are causing harm because there's a lot of vulnerable people out there where their hearts can go out of the rhythm by these unseen waves.
So I know there are several different aspects to this. Could you please talk about the following? About the earthing mat, that you speak to earthing sheets and earthing tools. Could you talk about the role of possibly electrolytes or maybe amino acids like taurine?
Sure, sure.
Could those things have something to do with atrial fibrillation?
Yeah, I mean, anything you can do to the body to support what we call heart rate variability is crucial in preventing what we call ectopic arrhythmias. Because we do know that disturbed heart rate variability can be a prognosticator of what we call sudden cardiac death, you know, in the cardiovascular circles. So how do you support heart rate variability? Well, one of the things is, you know, don't take drugs that can offset it. And one of the worst class of drugs would be the short-acting calcium channel blockers. They can disrupt heart rate variability. Some of the drugs that men take for the prostate gland, we call them alpha blockers. That can disrupt heart rate variability. Certainly, a lot of these asthmatic medications that children take, and adults as well, can disrupt heart rate variability. Air pollution is a big factor. Air pollution fires up what we call a sympathetic nervous system, which then disrupts what we call the entire autonomic nervous system and it impairs the heart rate variability as well. I mentioned radio frequency, working near computers or being next to a cordless phone. And I know I mentioned this on another show of yours, Eber, maybe 6 months ago when I was in my home in Florida, telling you that, one of the most dangerous things you can have in your home is a cordless phone. I mean, if anybody's listening now, I would tell people to just throw them out and, you know, get these plug-in little Princess phones for $25 and use them. I mean, I'm talking on one of these phones right now. I mean, I would never have a cordless phone in my house. And unfortunately, I did 5 years ago because I didn't realize, you know, how toxic they were. But, like, there's so many things you can do to improve heart rate variability. I mentioned some of the things that disrupt it. There was cough medicines, for example, that were on the market a few years ago. And some of these cough medicines caused a lot of arrhythmias and even sudden deaths because they were getting their hearts out of rhythm. You know, so, you know, pharmaceutical drugs can do it. Certainly the radio frequency can do it. What are the good things? What are some of the things that can assuage the heart, like put a blanket on the heart, calm the heart to the point where the sympathetic nervous system is more balanced? Well, certainly walking barefoot is one, you know, or sleeping grounded or using grounded mats. But I tell people to walk barefoot as much as they can or just put your feet on the grass in your backyard or something like that. That's a great way of discharging the autonomic nervous system. So, we did a clinical study on that and published that in Integrative Medicine. Another good thing is omega-3s, like fish oil or krill oil. I particularly like calamarine oil or squid oil because, you know, it has more DHA content in, which is absorbed more by the retina of the eye, the brain, and the heart. So those cells, for a cardiologist like myself, are very important. So, you know, I like, you know, omega-3 coming from DHA, and that has a favorable impact on heart rate variability. Certainly meditation and prayer, yoga, when you're breathing into postures, whenever you breathe into a discomfort or a twist or a certain posture, that stimulates what we call a parasympathetic nervous system, which then eases out the autonomic nervous system, balances it out, and the heart rate variability becomes improved. So, you know, not having anger or, having joy will increase what we call DHEA and lower cortisol. Whenever you do that, you support heart rate variability. So there's lots of things, you know, people can do to really protect themselves. The problem is that awareness is curative, and, you know, a lot of people really aren't privy to these things, but, you know, it's very simple. You know, it's being showing a lot of gratitude and not seeing yourself as a victim.
Okay. So how do people, well, there is one more thing I want to ask before I go here. When men have endothelial problems, there's always a problem that usually accompanies it with erectile dysfunction. Is that true?
Yeah,
there's
an old saying in cardiology that endothelial dysfunction and erectile dysfunction share the same pathway. So if a man has atherosclerosis, and if that atherosclerosis, or if there's plaquing in the arteries, if it's in his, let's say, if it's in his heart, it's bad, or if it's in his carotid, it's bad. But lots of times this is a diffuse process, and if it happens in a groin, like in the femoral arteries, then it can impede blood flow. And so erectile dysfunction often parallels endothelial cell dysfunction, and the treatment is about the same. We like to give nitric oxide in small doses. That's why I really like, you know, when I was treating heart disease on a day-to-day basis, I would, you know, have my men eat a lot of kale because it's one of the best vegetables for eliciting nitric oxide, and grapeseed extract is good for that. Vitamin C is good for that. And, you know, we would try to literally try to heal the, not only the endothelial cell dysfunction, but if the male had the erectile dysfunction at the same time. I really like vitamin K2 as well, because this helps take plaque out of vessels, and it actually puts calcium back into bones where it belongs, and it takes it out of blood vessels where it doesn't belong. So, you know, by using, you know, nitric oxide derivatives, grapeseed extract, pycnogenol also is good, you know, certainly vitamin C, and using vitamin K2, we would treat endothelial dysfunction as well as erectile dysfunction at the same time.
Okay. I just wanted to say, before we had the difficulty, we were talking about the interview that you did back about 6 months ago or so. For anybody that wants to hear that interview, that was February 24th, and it is located in our archives on BBS Radio, so you can find it and listen to Dr. Sinatra talk there. So many people have addictions to sugar and just can't seem to step away from that bowl of pasta or that piece of bread. So I wanted to ask you, this new low-glycemic pasta that's on the market, I don't know if it is where you are, but it is where I am, and things like Ezekiel bread, can they cheat there a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Why not? I mean, you know.
Does it make a difference?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, when it comes to sugar, I mean, we don't want to kill the pleasure of everybody. But when it comes to sugar, less is more. So, I mean, what I do in my own life right now, I used to eat a lot of pasta years ago. I mean, I used to buy into the, you know, the high-carb, low-fat. I was a big believer in that when I believed in the cholesterol theory of heart disease because, you know, when you avoid fat, you're also avoiding cholesterol. So when I... But you wouldn't believe it, Eva. I weighed 15, 20 pounds more than I weigh now. I got a little bit of insulin resistance. I was eating bread and pasta and salads, all vegetarian for, you know, that was most of my meals with a lot of vegetables. And I became insulin resistant, and I put on weight. But I don't do that anymore. I mean, you know, it's all about balance. What I would tell my patients, I say, look, use less sugars as much as you can. You know, if you have to have a sugar in your coffee or tea, use ribose. I mean, ribose is a low glycemic sugar that builds ATP at the same time. It's a real game changer, and it's a real winner.
That's a great idea.
And then as far as
we're going to talk about with John St. Cyr and with Ralph Halsworth, is they have a new ribose product. Somebody just now emailed me about atrial fibrillation again.
Yeah, that's what
so
we were just talking about.
You,
yeah.
What about is electrolytes, being low in electrolytes, will that have, and water, could that do it?
Well,
or taurine?
Electrolytes are really important. I mean, most people are mineral deficient in this country right off the bat because our soils don't have the minerals that they used to have. Magnesium is one in point. I mean, our soils are so low in magnesium that we're not getting enough magnesium. And the same thing is true of potassium. You know, if a lot of us are drinking a lot of tea and coffee and even these drinks that have these high caffeine drinks that, you know, kids use to stay awake for exams and stuff like that, they're losing a lot of vital minerals, magnesium, potassium, calcium, B vitamins. Same thing is true when people take a lot of diuretics. You know, you're losing these minerals, and you can't get them back fast enough. You just can't get them back unless if you're eating a lot of fruits and vegetables with high mineral content, or if you're taking minerals as a supplement. So, I mean, I believe in minerals as a supplement. I mean, I've developed powders at drsinatra.com, you know, where I give 500 of magnesium and 100 of, I'm sorry, 500 of potassium, 100 of magnesium, and you give all the different minerals, and I just feel that minerals are so crucial. Because if you look at our society, we're a sugar society. We drink a lot of alcohol. We do a lot of coffee and tea and stimulants. It's the perfect storm for wiping minerals out of the body, and we're not getting them back because our soils are deficient. So mineral supplementation is huge, you know, particularly when it comes to any arrhythmias in the heart.
We have about 6 minutes left, and somebody just emailed this email. My husband is in the cardiac unit right now. Atrial fibrillation plus postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, and no one knows what to do. Please, can you help me?
Well, the thing to do right now is to try to correct the atrial fibrillation. I mean, you know, it depends on whether he has structural heart disease or not. I mean, I'm sure they're going to do an ultrasound of the heart, look at chamber size. They might do a cardioversion and get the heart in regular rhythm. But if he has postural hypotension, what's happening is that his heart rate is beating so fast that the heart rate is not filling up, the heart's not filling up with blood enough, and basically it's not perfusing the body and the blood pressure is low. So if they correct the heart rate or lower the heart rate or even cardiovert them, the blood pressure will come up. Now, what does he do when he goes home, you know, when he's out in the real world again? Well, certainly, you know, if he has no heart failure or, you know, he just has atrial fibrillation, this is one individual that I would give sea salt to or Himalayan salt or natural sea minerals to help expand what we call violent expansion. So I like salt in these people. Not processed salt, you know, but I'm talking about the Celtic salts and the sea salts that have minerals in them as well. In addition, I would put this gentleman on a metabolic cardiology program, which would include, you know, 100 to 200 milligrams of CoQ10, ribose, five grams three times a day or a teaspoon three times a day, some carnitine and magnesium. And I'm sure most cardiologists would agree with that treatment now because it just makes sense. A lot of these people with rapid atrial fibrillation, they lose ATP, and it takes the body, you know, many, many weeks to get it back. And one of the best ways of getting it back quickly is to take ribose, which really forms the center of the ATP molecule, and you give carnitine and CoQ10 and magnesium to increase the turnover. So, I, if that was a patient of mine in the real world, I mean, that's what I would do.
And you have a book, actually, on metabolic cardiology right now. So we have about 3 or 4 minutes. So I'd like for you to tell us about your books, where we can find them. And I'd also like to remind people we have 4 more segments. The other 4 segments over the next 4 weeks will be on the Eva Herr Show on Revealing Talk Radio. Afterwards, we will rerun all 5 of the shows on both Infinite Consciousness on BBS and on the Eva Herr Show on Revealing Talk Radio, so you will be able to hear all of them again. So could you tell us about your books and the metabolic cardiology books, please?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote metabolic cardiology back in 2005, and the reason why I wrote it was just to give people new hope with you know, devastating heart disease. I mean, metabolic cardiology, I mean, to me is awesome. Because basically what I believe is if you have, I don't care how sick you are. I mean, I had people who needed, so many people needed heart transplants in my career. And I'm even following a 29-year-old right now who has a single outlet ventricle. He's probably the oldest living child in the country. And I've been holding him together with metabolic cardiology ever since the age of 14. And he's had multiple heart surgeries, but he doesn't want a heart transplant. But having said that, what metabolic cardiology does, it takes a very compromised, energy-starved heart, and you're putting energy back into the heart cells. And when you do that, you're allowing the heart to work more efficiently. The other thing that metabolic cardiology does, and I don't care how severe your heart disease is, metabolic cardiology will buy you time for your intrinsic stem cells to take over. Now, Eva, you had a heart attack, right, last September. All you got to do is live a few more decades more, and your heart, by its natural stem cells in your bone marrow, your heart's going to be replaced 20% to 30%, you know, over a few decades. In fact, the average heart over a period of 100 years, if people live that long, is replaced 40% to 45%. So almost half your heart is replaced by intrinsic stem cells. And it makes sense. That's what God gave us. I mean, look, the body has the wisdom to heal itself. The body has that intrinsic wisdom. All we need to do is to give it the raw materials so the body can help heal itself. And that's why metabolic cardiology is so crucial.
I actually just got an email from our producer, and he said that we can go longer. Would you like to do that?
Sure. I have no problem with that. No problem.
Okay. Because we do have some more stuff we could talk about. Inflammation. We talked about that at the very beginning of the show. How does somebody know that they might be that person that has inflammation that they're not aware of? What are some signs and symptoms?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, because you don't go into a doctor's office and say, I have inflammation. I mean, some people are lucky, you know, if they have psoriasis or if they eat a lot of gluten and the psoriasis flares, that's inflammation. Or, you know, if the body becomes very toxic and you get eczema or skin problems, I mean, that's a sign of inflammation. But, you know, most people don't know that. Most people have what we call silent inflammation. And just ask your doctor to do some laboratory tests on you that can pick up silent inflammation. And the easiest ones are like C-reactive protein will pick up silent inflammation, fibrinogen. These are tests that, you know, the doctor can order. These are routine lab tests that laboratories do. So if your homocysteine, fibrinogen, ferritin, C-reactive protein are elevated, well, then you have lots of inflammation. There's also what we call an AA-EPA ratio, which measures arachidonic acid with eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA. But these laboratories are specialized. Not all laboratories do this. You may have to send your blood to specialized laboratories or some of the laboratories in Canada. But just ask your doctor to do some inflammatory blood tests on you, some of the easy ones like I mentioned. And if those tests are positive, then you have to do things to offset the inflammation in your body. And sometimes it might be very simple, you know, just lowering iron or going on a gluten-free diet or, taking away things that cause inflammation. You know, certainly heavy metals that cause inflammation. Trans fats, omega-6 oils. People don't realize the amount of inflammation that omega-6 oils use. I mean, people in, you know, they're frying in canola oil and corn oil and, oh, my God, these vegetable oils are very, very pro-inflammatory, and they cause inflammation in the body. And like I mentioned before at the beginning of the show, it's sugar. I mean, sugar is the number one cause of inflammation in the body, and it causes early aging. So, you know, and again, it's not just the sugar you put in your tea and your coffee, but, you know, we talked about this, a lot of the breads and, you know, a lot of the flours that you're eating. So I like to have people eat less of breads and flours and chips and things like that can cause inflammation.
Let's talk about, go back just a minute to the atrial fibrillation. What about the amino acids such as taurine? We didn't go to that part,
you know,
of it.
I used to use taurine and hawthorn berry in treating atrial fibrillation years ago, even cactus flower. But I really did not see the impact that I saw with, my awesome foursome or metabolic cardiology. Now, I do use taurine in treating refractory heart failure and hawthorn in refractory heart failure. In other words, these are people who have heart failure despite the awesome foursome, you know, Q10, carnitine, ribose, and magnesium. And some of these people, I did have to add hawthorn, like 1,500 milligrams a day or 3 to 4 grams of taurine. And I got a complimentary response. But I have to tell you, with atrial fibrillation, I did not see, really outstanding responses like I did with refractory heart failure.
Okay. So does the role of water and potassium have anything to do with keeping your heartbeat stable?
Well, potassium is crucial. The problem with potassium is that you don't want to have too little and you don't want too much. This is one electrolyte that you want to have in the middle. So, I mean, If people are on diuretics, for example, I like them to take additional potassium in daily. I mean, because potassium is a very, very important mineral for keeping the heart in regular rhythm. When potassium gets too low or too high, you know, the heart can develop arrhythmias or even stop. So this is one mineral that we want to keep our eye on. And, you know, as long as you don't have renal insufficiency, I mean, most people have, or adrenal problems, most people's potassiums are within a normal range. But most good doctors will check electrolytes on people, especially on people with diuretics, at least a few times a year.
Can you talk just a moment about, and I don't know how much time you have, because we have a few minutes now that we can go. So you let me know when you want to go, okay?
Sure.
Talk a minute about using oils at high temperatures. Is that okay?
Not really, because, look, if you use an extra virgin olive oil at a high temperature, you're going to turn a monounsaturated fat to more saturated fat, and because it has a lower dew point. But if you like olive oil and you want to cook an olive oil at a low temperature, use a lighter oil. Don't use an extra virgin. So I would tell my people never to cook with an extra virgin. But if they like the taste of olive oil, to use a very, very light oil because the dew point's higher. Now, when it comes to people like the sauté in oils, I like coconut oil because it has a very high dew point. The problem with canola oil and corn oil is that when you fry in these oils or sauté in these oils, these oils on higher temperatures, they change their configuration more. This is where a saturated fat like coconut oil is so much more stable, it's so much what we call it's resistant to oxidation, as opposed to the omega-6 oils like the canolas, like the corn, like the cottonseed, soy oils, for example. These oils are much more prone to oxidation, and I don't like the heat. I use high heat in these oils at all.
So if you just have one of the kind of stoves like I do where it goes low, medium, medium, high, where should your setting be?
Well, it depends on what if you're sauteing, let's say, a piece of wild
salmon. If you really want to be healthy and you're taking it serious and you're just doing what you got to do, where do you not want to go?
Well, when it comes to oils, I would go low to medium. I wouldn't go high.
Okay.
I wouldn't go high. Now, if you wanted to use, take something like butter, for example, an organic butter. An organic butter, it's a saturated fat. This is going to be very, very resistant to oxidation. But again, when you go in very, very high heats with fats, you're going to change the architecture of the fats. So when it comes to high heat, very high heat, like a red-hot heat, I don't like to really, bubble those fats at those high heats because you're going to change the architecture and the chemistry of those fats.
Okay. So could you talk a little bit about blood viscosity?
Oh, my favorite thing. Blood viscosity is where it's all at. And I know you're going to have Ralph on, very, very good man about blood viscosity. That's the whole essence of cardiovascular disease is really blood viscosity. I mean, the problem with most Americans today, our blood is like red ketchup. And the reason it is because, it's our diet. With all the sugar in the diet, the high fructose corn syrups, the preservatives, and the omega-6 oils are very plentiful in the diet. So our diet is responsible, and there's so much radio frequency out there from computers and cordless phones, cellular phone, the cell phone towers. We can't escape the RF. So basically our blood is becoming thicker and thicker. And when it becomes thicker, it becomes more like red ketchup as opposed to red wine. So what I like people to do is, and you brought it up before, is hydration. Hydration is good. Potassium is good. Magnesium is good. Sea minerals are good. Omega-3 essential fatty acids are good for thinning the blood. And I really like earthing and grounding because I was the first to do that study where we looked at earthing and grounded, and within 2 hours, we could change the blood from red ketchup to red wine. And by the way, there was a woman, actually you gave me her information, Beverly,
Beverly Rubik.
Yeah, I contacted her. She understands the Schumann effect. The Schumann effect is Mother Earth energy. In other words, when you put your bare feet on the earth, you're taking in the Schumann effect. It's less than a milligauss, but it has a frequency of 7.83 hertz. Which is, I mean, who cares? But that's the frequency. But what Beverly did was that she infused water with the Schumann frequency, the 7.83 hertz. And what she found, that people who drank the water, it thinned the blood, just like what we showed, earthing thins the blood, and she used dark field. So, I contacted her because, I got this idea in my mind about walking grounded and drawing blood, a couple of hours later or an hour later to see if the dark field would change in the blood. Because, we did it in the laboratory situation, but I like to do it in the real world where, you're walking barefoot or on maybe some conductive, shoes, and to see if it thins the blood. Because if you do thin the blood, and we call that increasing zeta potential, and whenever you do that, you're giving an increased velocity to your red blood cells. And whenever you're doing that, you're going to have less of a chance of clotting blood, because you don't want to clot blood in your brain or your heart, because you'd have a heart attack or a stroke. So when it comes to heart disease, the thinner the blood, the better. But unfortunately, because of the way of life in this 21st century with the RF and the radio frequency and our diets and the emotional stress we're under, everything thickens the blood. We need to have thin blood, and when we do that, we're stepping in the right direction.
Our good friend, Danion Brinkley, called me the other day, and we were talking about blood thickness, and he said, I have a really good friend, family member, that is on Coumadin, and this person has been trying to get off that Coumadin for 20 years and doesn't know how to do it. Can you get off Coumadin and use, like, Natakinase or NK2? How do you do that?
Well,
because I know that person's listening.
Yeah, well, here's the deal with Coumadin. If you have serious heart disease, like a prosthetic valve or a metallic valve, and you can't stop Coumadin because, natokinase or even lumbrokinase, which is stronger than natokinase, or even earthing, nobody's done that study on these situations where the blood can clot with a prosthetic valve. Now, if you have atrial fibrillation and your mitral valve isn't leaking too much, or if your left atrium is on the small side, it's not a big, baggy left atrium, did I get some of my patients off Coumadin? Sure I did, and I put those people on natokinase or lumbrokinase, and I grounded those people, and they did very, very well. But these were people who had atrial fibrillation with no evidence of other heart disease, and their chamber size was normal, and we call that LONE, L-O-N-E, atrial fibrillation. If somebody has atrial fibrillation for 20 years, I doubt that their left atrium is, small. I would suspect it to be significantly enlarged, and I would not want to take that person off Coumadin that I know works and then put them on an alternative, because, let me tell you, Eva, strokes are bad, and I've seen lots of strokes in my lifetime, and you don't want to, mess around with serious heart disease, because sometimes the outcome could be a disaster. So does Coumadin have a light side and a dark side? Absolutely. But when it comes to preventing, stroke in these people with high vulnerability to stroke, like, a very, very large atrial fibrillation, a lot of mitral regurgitation in the heart, or somebody with a prosthetic valve, I still choose Coumadin over lumbrokinase or natokinase.
Okay, it's kind of scary to think about.
Well, it is and it isn't, but, a lot of people are unnecessarily on Coumadin too, so you just got to tease it out, and the people who have the most vulnerability for stroke need to be on Coumadin, but there's a lot of people that could be placed on, alternatives, but they got to be followed by a cardiologist carefully and look at echocardiograms and chamber size and stuff like that.
Okay. I want to say one thing, then I have two questions, and then you can we can go or you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. I just want to say that on my path, it's been really scary for me sometimes. Sometimes it's been really victorious for me and exciting and titillating. But back in May, you remember that day when I called you crying? Maybe it was June.
Yeah, I
went
Florida,
back to this. I don't go to the doctor. I don't really have a doctor. But I decided I wanted to go back to the cardiologist and just see kind of what he had to say. And I got an echocardiogram. And when I was in the lab getting the echocardiogram, the lab worker got this funny look on her face, and she went, I got to go get my supervisor. And I'm like, well, what is it? And I was doing great until that day. And that day set me back for over maybe 6 weeks. It was almost like I needed permission to be okay. Because when I walked in there and I felt like $1 million, and I walked out because they harassed me because I wasn't on pharmaceutical drugs. When I walked out, it took me 6 weeks to recover from that appointment at the doctor. So I just want people to know that you have permission to feel good, regardless what your path is. It's okay. And remember that day when I called you or you called me or whatever it was, and I was crying, and you said, Eva, don't worry about the numbers. Worry about how you feel.
Oh, yeah.
You gave me permission to be okay without the pharmaceuticals.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people worry
and I
about
thank
numbers.
You for that.
That's so insignificant. That's so insignificant. And even, you know, that was an unfortunate situation. Look. Here's the truth about heart disease. I have seen the worst cases of heart disease that you can imagine, and it's all about intention. When people feel that, you know, they can overcome their illness, and when they feel that, you know, they're going to partner with the doctor or they're going to do things, it's how you feel that counts. It's not what your ejection fraction is or you know, what your cholesterol is or your triglycerides. It's not that. It's really the bottom line is how you feel, and that's really, really extraordinarily important. So, unfortunately, a doctor's, you know, grimace or a technician's unsmile or not smiling or concern can really set people off, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, it happens all the time.
I mean, yeah, I know we have lots of doctors listening, so I just want to say be careful with your bedside manner, because Your emotions and how you talk to that patient affects them. Give them permission to be well. Now, one more thing, just because I'm trying to touch on a lot of little topics, and that's B vitamins and lactic or acidosis. Do you have anything to say about either one of those? And ammonia, three things. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I like strong B vitamin support because you know what it does to, you know, homocysteine. But very, very important, the MTHFR is extraordinarily important because we're seeing a lot of brain inflammation today. And that's why I'm putting MTHFR in most of my products now. And the same thing is true with vitamin B12. We used to use cobalamin because methylcobalamin is very, very expensive. But we need stronger B12 and we need better folic acids today because of, again, the environment. You know, things are changing, and, you know, we need these highly bioavailable compounds. So when it comes to B vitamins, your audience should be listening to the MTHFR. It is much more common than we thought it is, and it's almost like gluten intolerance. It's almost like acquired now as opposed to genetics, so that should be a good show. You know, ammonia, acidosis, these things, I mean, this is why I like the carnitines. You know, it helps with that. Anybody with renal insufficiency has to worry about ammonia. You know, people with liver disease, you know, have to worry about that. I mean, if the body is becoming too acidic, and a lot of it can be coming from diet. I mean, it's sugar, candida, all that stuff. You know, it creates an acidosis in the body. And if we're doing a lot of sugar and high fructose corn syrup, you know, and a lot of dairy and a lot of meat, you know, all these things that can create acidosis, we just got to balance it out. And this is where, again, a plant-based diet will help balance out, you know, a lot of the acidosis of dairy, meat, sugar, and those constituents. So I like the 80-20 rule. Again, I like, you know, I do like plant-based, but, you know, meat and dairy have their advantages as well. You know, certainly, you know, CoQ10, carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, and B12 are found in the animal kingdom. So, you know, it's a good idea to balance. The other thing that I like about the alkalinity of some of the plant foods is that I find that cucumbers and peppers and avocado, those types of foods are really good for, you know, helping to bring out would help to neutralize a lot of the acidosis in the body. Because, again, it's a typical American diet, a processed diet. It's going to make us more acidic. And when we get too acidic, you know, then that can have an effect on blood, but not only blood viscosity, but also, you know, the whole internal milieu of the body, and it throws the body out of homeostasis, and it can affect even the autonomic nervous system as well.
Are you concerned about all the folic acid in the food?
I'm concerned that people are taking a high-dose folic acid in milligram forms. Even doctors were doing this, taking 5 milligrams, 2.5 milligrams. You know, 100 micrograms of, let's say, or 100 milligrams of MTHFR will go a long way as opposed to 1,000 milligrams of folic acid. So I am more in favor.
People with a methylation problem, though, can't use that, and it's like poison.
Well, you can't. I mean, that's the problem. And more people are developing this. And, you know, again, I think a lot of it has to do to the environment that we're living in today. So, again, the MTHFR will go a long way. It's just that, it's much more expensive, much more complex, but it's much more bioavailable to the body. I don't think the lower doses of folic acid, even if you can't assimilate it, it's not going to poison you. It's just, you know, your body's just not going to use it.
Okay. Is there anything that you would like to talk about before we end?
No, I mean, I'm pretty complete. We're going to be on the phone again in a couple of weeks, right? September 3rd.
That's right. We are going to be back on the phone on Tuesday, September 3rd, except this time it'll be on the Eva Hirsch Show on Revealing Talk Radio. Be sure and tune in on Tuesday night for Benjamin Lynch. We're going to talk about MTHFR. And methylation and the genetic information behind MTHFR. So join us at 8 o'clock then. Thank you, Dr. Sinatra. You're the best.
Thank you, Eva.
And I'm grateful for you.
Okay. See you on the 3rd.
Thank you for taking the time.
God bless.
Good night.